Ah, spring. Nothing like the world progressing towards summer to inspire your own progress. That's what life's all about, in your career, relationships, and your finances. Let's talk about that last one. With the Chime Secured Credit Builder Visa Credit Card, it's easy to start building credit with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments with no annual fees or interest. So your weekly grocery run can feel even more productive, and that morning coffee can taste like a little victory. And if your credit scores grow, so could your opportunities to get lower rates on loans, like for a new ride or finally having a home to call your own. Sounds like progress, right? With Chime's secure credit card, you can start improving your credit scores right away. Get started today at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. Chime feels like progress. The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal and OTC advance fees may apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's never too early to learn that the government is a greedy piglet that suckles on a taxpayer's teat until they have sore, chapped nipples.
Hey guys, welcome back to Paul's to the Wall. I am your host, Mike Paul. Today I am joined by my good buddy Tyler. Nick is not going to be able to make it because he came down with laryngitis, which does not bode well for podcasting. However, we do have the privilege of being joined by the great Gene Epstein. So Gene, how are you doing today?
Good, and good to be back with you guys on Paul's to the Wall.
Well, we're happy to have you. So a lot's changed since the last time we spoke. I think
what was that?
Earlier this year, maybe. But I think we've probably it's about $6 trillion ago by Fed's measurement. So, but a couple of things I want to talk about is first of all, there's a lot of big events going on this year. I know Pork Fest is next week, I believe.
Basically next week, starting a week from I lost track. The 22nd, 23rd. So that's in week and a half.
Okay. You'll be at that event as well as Freedom Fest. So just want to tell the listeners a little bit about each of the events and what your role is at each of them and why they should attend.
Oh, wow. Yes. And since you mentioned the $6 trillion, I thought it would launch into our dire outlook for the economy.
We'll get
but
there.
You want to talk about happier things, and that's a good place to start. First, I do want to say to podcast listeners, since you do tend to listen to podcasts, you people out there, The Soul Forum Debates podcast is where you can get all of our debates at the Soul Forum. I've done three debates with socialists. I've got that socialist trilogy that's recorded at the Soul Forum Debates podcast. I've done four others, and there are more than 50 debates that we've got at the Soul Forum Debates podcast. So I do recommend that. But to get to Mike's question about what's coming up, the Soul Forum is going to Pork Fest for the very first time, and we're being given the red carpet treatment Dennis Pratt, who's running it up there, who is really a great guy. I was up at New Hampshire over Memorial Day weekend, and I did a session at the Shell with a lot of free staters, in which they watched my recent debate on socialism and then put me in the hot seat. We did a video of that event and also some interviews of free staters, and that will be coming out shortly. You'll have to join our Facebook page in order to watch that video, but I think it was a very good ad for the free state. And Dennis Pratt, a guy in his 60s who's running Pork Fest, surprised me in a way by telling me that the whole purpose of Porkfest is to attract people to move to the free state of New Hampshire. So Mike and Todd, you've got to bear that in mind. I do speak somewhat hypocritically because it doesn't look as though I'll be moving to the free state. I've been living in New York City for over 50 years. I'm 76 years old. Maybe it's a little bit too late for me to move, but you guys should think about it. They're very, very committed to the idea that maybe the best thing that libertarians can do to fight for the cause of libertarianism is to dominate that one state and then, of course, ultimately secede from the union and make Bitcoin the currency. All that good stuff could happen. So I haven't even gotten to the answer to your question about what's happening at Porkfest. They're giving us a red carpet because I'm going to be moderating three debates. One of them will be about Bitcoin. The second and third were basically concocted by Dennis Pratt. And one of them is about bigotry and libertarians. How should libertarians feel toward bigots? And Dennis told me that an African-American is actually going to defend the resolution that bigots should be welcome to the libertarian movement. The fact that you're a bigot doesn't necessarily mean that you're not a libertarian. So that would be a rather provocative debate that I'm looking forward to. And then the third debate will be a debate between Angela McCardle, who will be defending the strategic idea, the best thing for libertarians to do is to promote and join the Libertarian Party, versus a homegrown person who will be arguing that strategically the scarce resources of the libertarians should be focused on building the free state of New Hampshire. And when you think about scarce resources, then in a way it isn't like you could do both. You know, there are priorities in life. And so I think that will also be a very provocative debate. I recommend it. Then the fourth event will be a long lecture by me, interactive with the audience, which I've been preparing for. It's my Bleeding Heart Capitalism lecture on why why the rising tide lifts all boats in the capitalist system and how government screws that up. That I think those lessons are not well enough understood by libertarians. So Dennis is going to give me the opportunity to deliver a 90-minute talk. Much of it is going to be interactive. I'm going to talk for about 30 minutes and then pause for questions and an interaction with the audience, and then go on to the next topic. I probably won't have enough time to cover all the topics that are related to that very important issue of the rising tide lifting all boats. I guess to some degree as a preview, I study the numbers, and I know that there is a myth that wages and salaries have fallen behind over the last 20 to 30 years, and that's simply not true based upon a decent and hard look at the numbers. But it's a myth that many mainstream economists have perpetrated, as well as even pro-market publications like the Wall Street Journal. Well, that's going to be Porkfest. And the bad news for everybody out there is that it's all sold out. 2,500 tickets have been sold. I asked Dennis, don't you expect a lot of people to sort of gate crash? He said, yeah, I do. And that's why we have to limit it to 2,500. I said, well, then why not just sell, 3,500 tickets? He said, well, there is the sewage problem. You know, the sewage problem of an open place. They have all the porta potties out there. So Dennis is going to have to deal with the sewage. And that is going to mean that this will be quite a spectacle. It's the biggest event ever for libertarians. Getting to Freedom Fest, which is where I'm also going to go, and that's going to be in South Dakota. I'm going to be moderating a debate between John Mackey and Yaron Brook about the corporation. Freedom Fest is a lot of good libertarian events. I've been a little bit critical of it because it's tilted a little bit too much toward investment and to issues as well, which are of interest, but I think it's a little bit too much of that. Too many investment advisors setting up a shop to solicit business, and then a little bit too much of a neoconservative viewpoint. But the big attraction, and the reason why I really recommend going there, is that Tom Woods is going to have his own day at Freedom Fest, and he's going to devote much of that day to Scott Horton, That is going to be terrific. I think that Scott Horton, whom your listeners probably have heard of. Have you guys ever had Scott on the show?
Yes, we have. Yep.
Well, I think Scott is arguably our only authentic genius. There's nothing he can't recall about foreign policy. When he gets going, his insights are just incredible. The only downside is that sometimes he knows so much that he loses us a little bit, but I think he's improved in that regard. But I highly recommend, the sort of stuff he can come up with and his book, Fool's Errand, read by him. It's too bad that he's supposed to be coming out with an audible version of his new book, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terror, but read by him. It's too bad he hasn't brought it out yet. So I recommend FeedInvest, especially because Scott Horton is going to be there. And to shift to the Scott Horton theme about what else is being planned, we have finally gotten Bill Kristol, William Kristol, the father of neoconservative foreign policy, to debate Scott Horton in New York City on October 4th at a very large space, the Symphony Space Theater on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And greatly to our dismay, here's the bad news. The Symphony Space will not allow anybody as a member of the audience unless that person brings a document showing proof of vaccination. And we are bothered by that. I'm outraged by that. But that's the hand that's being dealt us in New York City. Any large venue is going to give us the same problem. Ironically, they have said that anybody on our staff doesn't have to show proof of vaccination as long as you show proof that you don't have COVID. So we were hoping that the audience could exercise that option, proof that you don't have COVID, but Symphony Space is insisting, no, you got to have proof of vaccination. And so a lot of people are asking for refunds and aren't coming. On the other hand, we're selling big time anyway. Mm-hmm. A lot of people really want to come to that event. The theater seats nearly 800, and we are definitely going to sell out with a waiting list. So that's October 4th. In New York City on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Well, those are the big events. I'm looking forward to them all. The Scott Horton debate with Bill Kristol was supposed to happen in May of last year, May of 2020, but because of the fascist lockdowns in New York City, we weren't able to do it. We did take our show on the road. We had two debates in Florida, my socialism debate in Florida. There was another debate between John Mackey and Yaron Brook in Florida. And in addition, of course, obviously, we're going to New Hampshire. We're going to South Dakota. And so we have taken our show on the road, but flesh is weak. We're based in New York City. We have a limited budget for travel. So that's where we're going to have most of our debates in the future. And that's about it. Those are all the exciting plans that are coming up for the Soul Forum and for Porkfest, Freedom Fest, and for Scott Horton versus Bill Kristol.
I just want to say how much I respect how much work you're putting in with all these events, right, and how much enthusiasm surrounds it has been extremely encouraging to me. Right. I mean, I know I spoke with Freedom Fest because we'll be there as a media.
You will be. Well. Oh, that's great. That's great.
And, they said they sold out like their early bird tickets right away back in May or March, I believe. And they're getting a huge gathering. Sounds like Pork Fest. I wish I could make it there maybe next year. This year's hard with the little kids, but
It's called Pork Fest. Why is it called Pork Fest? Because they refer to themselves as porcupines.
Correct.
A lot of people think that it has to do with pigs, but no, it's about
porcupines. Right. The most libertarian animal in existence, the porcupine. Yes.
Yeah. Pigs are okay too, but not if you've read Animal Farm by George Orwell.
Right.
So is Pork Fest directly associated or involved with the Free State Project, or are they kind of two separate projects that go hand in hand?
Yeah, in order to be able to answer those questions, you have to have a deep dive into what's going on. I myself am completely confused by some recent news that came out on Twitter about what's happened to the Libertarian Party in New Hampshire. I can't follow.
Yeah.
The people are really on the ground. I am on the ground in this sense. I had the privilege of spending a lot of time with Dennis Pratt. And Dennis and his wife live, they've got a place in New Hampshire. Dennis is a very, very committed libertarian, and he wants to maintain a certain distance from the group who run the Free State Project. I mean, I guess, look, you know, it's the old joke, you know, you ask, you get three Jews in a room, you've got four or five arguments going. I guess you've got three Jewish libertarians, you've got nine arguments. You know, it does dismay me a little bit that libertarians tend to get into seemingly more disputes than even left-wingers used to, but who knows, maybe that's not true. The point is that there's a little bit of a way of going your own way. Dennis took over Porkfest. He decided that he's going to charge only $30 a ticket. He wanted everybody to come. He decided also that he's not going to pay for anybody, any big name person to come who's going to charge him a pile of dough. To some degree, with Freedom Fest, Mark Gausen does that at Freedom Fest. You know, there's certain people that get ridiculous amounts of money to come, and certain others of us just get our costs paid for. In my case, I'm not charging anything, and the soil forum is going to pay for going up there. That doesn't directly answer your question. I know that Dennis wants to keep his distance a little bit from the Free State Project itself. He told me he could be chairman of the Free State Project, but he prefers not to be. He wants to maintain his independence. And so this really is very much, the Porkfest this year is really very much a Dennis Pratt creation.
Okay.
And so, which isn't to say that Dennis has any big issues with the people at the Free State Project. He wants to promote the Free State. So it's not as though there's any real acrimony. It's just that Dennis wants to do things his way. And of course, obviously, I completely empathize with it, since Soul Forum is a mom and pop shop also. You know, I talk to a lot of people. You guys give me good ideas for good debates. You guys can tell me what I might or might not do. But ultimately, it's just all me. You know, it's my little dictatorship. And it expresses me, and that's why I enjoy doing it, and that's Dennis. So he's a little bit independent, but as I say, he surprised me by saying, oh, the purpose of Porkfest is to attract people to move to the Free State. And, you know, you could say, I was a little surprised because I say, well, you know, also the purpose of Porkfest is just to attract, you know, 2,500 people to come who aren't necessarily going to stay. You know, it's not as though Freedom Fest is there to attract people to move to South Dakota. So that's a little bit different. On the other hand, I also told him that the film we did, the video we did, in which I had a really lively discussion with people at the Shell. The Shell is what they call this little meeting hall that they have. And it showed, you know, what a whole lot of smart people are up there. They have a community that can run a lot of good things. Hopefully, I mean, as Dennis is arguing, if you have only how many thousands of Free Staters are there up there, they're already having some influence on state politics. And so if you had a critical mass of libertarians, maybe you could have, you know, a liberty governor in the governor's mansion. You know, so I think that's all great. So anyway, as usual, I gave you more answer than you bargained for. I know that Dennis is a little bit running his own show, and of course I'm happy about the fact that he's giving us 90 minutes. I have to wave here to get the light back on. He's giving each of our debates 90 minutes. I want our debaters to be able to speak in paragraphs. I take a risk with downtime. Each of our debates is timed at 80 minutes, one-on-one. 80 minutes. And of course, we need a little bit of time in between. We need a little bit of time for the before and after Oxford style voting. So he's given it all, each of the three debates are given 90 minutes. So he's completely accommodated us. At Freedom Fest, I have to say the debate was going to run 50 minutes, which is a little less satisfactory. I know that, of course, if it's a one-on-one debate, if it's 80 minutes, there might be some longers, but I want to take a chance. I want a conversation. I want paragraphs. I want some deep thinking and deep exchanges, and that takes a little bit of time. So that's the format that I like, and that's what Dennis is accommodating. And who knows if that would have happened had I had a committee to deal with. All I have to deal with is Dennis Pratt, and I'm very happy about that.
Very cool. Well, Gene, that's a lot of positivity. So I think it's time we turn to the dark and not so fun conversations about the issues.
I thought it was done, guys. I thought that was it. Yeah.
So.
Okay, guys, I'm going to have to charge you $2.50 extra for my overtime. Go ahead. Yes.
Sounds great. Yeah. So, you know, just in my own anecdotal experience, I've been seeing a lot of employment shortages, just what I deal with in my career, and big businesses, small businesses having trouble finding steady employment, entry level work. And it's really driving up the price of labor for small businesses. So a lot of this, I think we can all agree, goes back to the government payments and unemployment and stimulus. So what kind of dangers do you see of this type of UBI type concept they're trying to, they seem to not indefinitely be installing. So what do you think this is going to have an impact on in the near future here?
I guess you and I are going to disagree about the indefiniteness of this. It looks as though the lot of states that are reacting to it, that are not extending the unemployment benefits, I believe that it's not going to last. I believe that while indeed you're absolutely right from your anecdotes that on the macro, so to speak, macro, I don't want to use the big picture level. I'd say to use the word macro because that's a mainstream term. Big picture level, I more or less trust the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers that compared to the peak of early last year, there are 5.5 million fewer people employed. The similar numbers apply to labor force participation. Even though the economy is coming back, the labor markets are only slowly coming back. There are now, again, over 5.5 million people on the sidelines compared to over a year ago. So that's a pretty big number. And however, we are adding hundreds of thousands of jobs every month. And I anticipate that that's going to continue to happen, and that a year from now, the UBI is going to vaporize and that people will get back to work. And so I don't anticipate anything permanent in place about that. And therefore, I guess I don't share your concern, unless you can tell me something I don't know about which way the political winds are blowing.
Oh, no. No, I was saying the way it seems to feel every time. It feels like there's a last one. There's a new one in the works. So I don't have a hard stance on that at all. I was just kind of curious what your takeaway has been from what's going on.
Yeah, well, no, as I say, there's been a backlash. There's been, I think, a basic understanding and basic eagerness that now, of course, that we're living in the post-Trump era, you no longer have to wreck the economy in order to bring down Trump. And so there is a desire to get people back to work and get the economy going again. All those checks and all the calculations I've read about how in certain states you can do far better not working than working. All of those, I think, are not going to last. They are temporary. It happened in 08, 09. It's happening now. But I believe that, again, a year from now, people will get back to work. That's, in a way, the so to speak, going forward and looking into the future, that's one of the least of my concerns. I guess I should add that invariably it does seem as though every time we have a downturn, we never quite get back to the labor force participation rate, for example, among prime age men that we had before. There's always a little bit of slippage, and over the long term, we're losing workers. But I believe that most of those 5 to 6 million workers who are not working are going to return to work. Although there'll be, over the long term, there will be a little bit of slippage on a net basis. But that, as I say, isn't a huge concern. I have many other concerns about the economy going forward.
Okay.
Would one of your concerns perhaps be the massive rise in housing costs?
Well, yeah. I mean, the two measures that are least readily available of bubble conditions, housing and the stock market, are clearly in bubble territory. I could elaborate on how those work. If you look at the house price to rent ratio. We do have reasonable figures available on average rents nationwide and, of course, house prices nationwide. We have a number of different snapshots of house prices. If you think about a house to rent ratio, then you see there's a kind of dynamic between the two. If you own a house, you could rent it out. That's income you can get from it if you own a house. Similarly, so you've bought the house and you might want to rent it out. Similarly, of course, if you're thinking of putting a roof over your head, then you could either buy a house or you could rent a house. And so therefore, the two have some relationship to each other, sort of similar to a price earnings ratio or price dividend ratio. And house prices are really sky high compared to rents right now. Similar in terms of the ratio to where they were, this ratio was in 2006 when we were in bubble conditions. And similarly, I prefer extra snapshots of the economy since we're always groping with the numbers that we have to sort of discern what's going on. The house price to price index ratio is also quite high. So in both those senses, we're looking at bubble conditions. On the other hand, we of course, then what's different about now versus then? On the one hand, we know that now versus then, we've got a mortgage interest rate that's even lower than it was then in 06. So therefore, that's clearly what is helping to bid up the price of a home, because obviously when you buy a home, the mortgage interest rate is clearly crucial. Mm-hmm. We've got very low mortgage interest rates artificially put there by government, and that's disconcerting. But we do have, in terms of housing, we do have certain legitimate fundamentals. We do have people moving out of cities, spreading out, wanting to buy homes. We do have, people have saved money, they want to buy homes, so that we have some legitimate demand for homes. And then on the supply side, we do have record low inventory of available homes. That is, so to speak, an understandable supply-demand situation. And then you'd hope that that's a price looking for more supply, that the high price is looking for more supply. And to some degree, I think it will find more supply. But of course, it's difficult to build in so many parts of the country. So that's a little bit of an ambiguous answer to your question. I think there is a source of concern about the potential for the bursting of a housing bubble. But I'm not sure that it will happen. Just I want to acknowledge that the measures are where the bubble conditions were in 06. I'm less worried about it than I would have been in 06. But I do see it. With respect to the stock market, there the measures are more conventional. Price to operating earnings ratio, that's the Standard & Poor's 500, which is calculated for us, operating earnings, that's in the bubble territory of, or close to it, that prevailed in 1999 going to 2000, when we had the big internet bubble bursting, we had PE ratios, price earnings ratios, that were about at that level then. Also, I would like to look at the price to dividends ratio. It's not quite as high as it was then, but we are still looking at a source of concern. How much higher can it go? You hopefully are looking for a stock market that responds to fundamentals, and earnings and dividends presumably are the fundamentals you want to look at. So I do see both of those measures that are available to us in bubble territory, and that's something. Those are both things that I think we should worry about. I could, perhaps you want to comment on that, because I could go into other things I'm worried about as well.
To kind of piggyback on the housing question, I'm sure you've seen this, and I know Mike and I were both discussing this earlier today about BlackRock currently buying up large amounts of homes and whole housing developments. And I've heard two different arguments for this. I've heard that they're, artificially driving up the price of homes and by doing this and trying to, the argument was essentially they're trying to further erode the middle class, and like, 'cause like home ownership is, if you, you know, generally speaking, it was a way to build equity, build wealth over time. If, you know, you live in a decent neighborhood and preserve your home. And the other argument I heard is that the companies like BlackRock don't actually trust the stock market. So they're buying up houses and like hard assets to kind of hedge their bets against the market. Which way are you kind of leaning on that? Or do you have a different take?
Let me just ask you this. When you talk about BlackRock wanting to erode the middle class, I'm saying, is that their purpose? Just to understand what you've just summarized.
So
that's their purpose in learning.
It was, I think the thread was hinting at,
no, go ahead, yes.
Kind of like the Great Reset argument where they're saying, you know, by you won't own anything and you'll like it. If you've heard that kind of tossed around before, like that was like the World Economic Forum presented this argument where they're like private property is, you know, they want to build, it was like, it was their kind of presentation for their view of a better modern world. Is essentially what they presented. Mike, wasn't it like it was like you'll own nothing and you'll be happy about it?
Yeah, by 2030 you'll own nothing and be happier for it.
Yeah,
the World Economic Forum.
This person I forget their username. It was on Twitter. They made a whole thread and they shared articles about how many homes and neighborhoods that BlackRock was buying, and they said that this is, you know, is an attack on like working class families that, you know, would buy a home and fix it up over time and build equity, and also a means of forcing people into renting by driving up the cost of homes artificially.
Well, because I believe they said BlackRock was buying houses for like 20 to 50% over cost. So like someone would put an offer in, and all of a sudden someone would put a $30,000 higher offer in, and it was BlackRock. So the average person could not keep outbidding them. But yeah, I haven't looked too big into it. I've heard a couple of podcasters talk about it. Tyler sent me a couple articles, but I'm still learning on it. And I was curious if you had heard anything either.
Well, I cannot imagine that BlackRock is moved by any kind of specific ideology about the way we should live, whether we should own things or not. I can only imagine that BlackRock is motivated by the desire for long-term profits, and therefore I could certainly conjecture that BlackRock could indeed be doing the second thing that you mentioned, Tyler. The idea there's more ambiguity to my mind in the housing bubble than there is in the stock market bubble. I'm still in stocks and I'm uncomfortable being in stocks. On the other hand, I can't time the market. And I would have been concerned about the stock market 2 years ago, and I would have lost out on a lot of profits. And so just sort of let it ride. And I guess I'll take my lumps, although I buy $1,000 worth of Bitcoin every month and $1,000 worth of gold, although that's not a whole lot in terms of what I own. But obviously, if I didn't own stocks and bonds, if I didn't accumulate over the course of my career, then I wouldn't be able to run the SOL Forum. So I care very much about ownership. And I don't know what fanatics are talking about not owning. As you know, the whole, I actually ironically take the other path with respect to home ownership. The whole policy of the U.S. with respect to offering a tax deduction on the mortgage interest rate, which, by the way, they don't offer in countries like Canada, has tried to emphasize and motivate home ownership to some degree. And of course, the fanaticism about home ownership is what caused the housing bubble of 06. Bill Clinton wanted to goose up home ownership. So did George W. Bush. And so the idea that people should own is still very much an ideology. I don't think it's so terrible to rent. And so I don't even share that passion. The idea that a whole lot of people don't want us to own anything, I think that just belongs to a fringe group of lunatics. Probably if you talk to most most politicians, that most of them are sort of, you know, are interested in people owning things, and they speak to those Republican politicians, certainly. So I don't quite buy that. But apart from that, as I say, I regard it as rather paranoid to think that BlackRock is motivated by ideology when presumably they're motivated by the wish for profits. That intrigues me. What they're doing intrigues me because you could argue that they are anticipating more home ownership, which you could anticipate because people are moving out, they are spreading out, there is a demand for homes, that or as well more supply is coming out, so they're buying up they're buying up homes because they're anticipating something profitable. So that's the only explanation I can give. I can't imagine anything diabolical about it. But again, I'd ask you guys, are you gonna think that BlackRock is run by ideology rather than the desire to make money? I assume that that's what they're run by. But the idea that they undermine the middle class, what's in it for them?
Right. I the only thing that I could say is because the gentleman that shared it on Twitter would lay out a much better argument for it than I did. I'll have to look for it, and if I do, I'll tag you in it.
He sounds like a raging paranoid, this guy.
It was a little paranoid, but yeah. I do think there might be some weight to like artificially, you know, by them offering more than market value, you know, 20-30% over. I mean, if they're going to profit off it, obviously inflating the housing prices by doing that in certain areas, it would benefit them in the long run.
I mean, the rents are low, and so therefore they're going to, if you own a home, that's why I was talking about the price to rent ratio. Rents are low, so they're going to charge rents on these homes, there could be I'd have to think about what is on their mind. They're smart people, smarter about the housing market than I am, and I dare say even you are. And I can imagine they believe that being a landlord for homes is a good idea. Renting out a home is a good idea. There may be some Byzantine tax benefit in this for them that's more than what you and I know about, you know. So that could be part of it as well. So that's the best that I could conjecture about that.
Now, are you familiar with the whole Great Reset, World Economic Forum thing going on?
Well, the reset that I know about is that they want more. They want government to dominate us, our lives, even more than ever. That's the reset,
right?
I'm aware of. But what reset are you guys aware of?
Well, I mean, Time Magazine did an article on it, I think, late last year.
Yeah.
The World Economic Forum put up a podcast about it. And I think even John Kerry made a statement talking about how COVID had given the perfectly fertile ground for this and how we have to rethink global capitalism. And we're on the brink of a very exciting time is how he phrased it.
Oh, sure. So, no. I mean, John Kerry is a climate alarmist. And so obviously, you know, we basically have to live off windmills and solar panels. And this kind of podcast that we're having could be blacked out at any moment if the wind stops blowing. Mm-hmm. And so, indeed, obviously, these people are a menace. The great resetters are a menace. I don't know if they will succeed. I think it's very difficult to defeat fossil fuels. The only thing I could see that's likely to happen is that fossil fuels are still going to prevail because even John Kerry wants to keep the lights on. But the U.S. is good. U.S. is the advantage, the domestic advantage the U.S. has with respect to oil is going to lessen, and we're going to become more and more dependent on, you know, Saudi oil, and on the Russians are going to benefit. So it's a little bit ridiculous. But the forces of the marketplace, I think, are difficult to contend with. So, with respect to fossil fuels in particular, since you mentioned John Kerry, he regards it as a great reset that we're going to roll back the carbon dioxide emissions, and I think that's not going to happen, so I look forward to the day that he realizes that he's been defeated. So I'm a little bit less fearful about their success at the Great Reset than you guys might be, unless you want to mention other aspects of the Great Reset that they want to bring about. I don't really think John Kerry, you think, wants nobody to, two-thirds of households own their own home. I was once listening to a lecture by a Wall Street economist who regarded it as a disaster to think that home ownership could go down to 60% from 70%. And I said, what kind of ideology are you pushing? You think it's so terrible if people rent apartments or rent their own homes? So I'm just saying that, generally speaking, you hear the opposite kind of emphasis. How great it is that people own their own homes. The home ownership rate has climbed back. I don't think that they can do very much to roll it back. People do want to own homes, and I don't think then that BlackRock is going to have much of an influence over that. I think it's going to be fiddling around the margins. Again, approximately 1/3 of households rent and 2/3 own. And of course, once you get up to the upper age groups, as you guys can imagine, it's the younger people who tend to rent and the older people who tend to own. And you get up to 80-85% home ownership rate once you're looking at people over the age of 45. I doubt very much that that's going to change. So they're up against the cussedness of the American people. And I think that their victories will be potentially, arguably, few and far between.
That's fair. You laid it out well. Yeah, I was curious because, I've been kind of like Mike said, people have been talking about BlackRock buying up a lot of homes, and I wasn't sure what the end goal is outside of, but utilizing them as income streams. Revenue streams, whether they're
they might. I could see an argument for, and possibly laced with some kind of cockamamie tax advantage. That's beyond me. You have to study the history of Warren Buffett, to realize that part of his great genius and success was all the tax arbitrage he did for Warren Buffett's success. So BlackRock may have figured something out that you and I don't know. And again, they're going to be landlords. They'll rent out homes, and in a way that's better news for people of limited means whose parents can't give them the down payment to buy a home. So I doubt very much that that's very much of a menace. But to get to what does concern me, in particular, it's clear that the printing press is going wild. The Federal Reserve is loading up on debt. At this stage, it would be usual for the Federal Reserve to take away the punch bowl. The economy is coming back. Price inflation is rising. By taking away the punch bowl, I mean that the Federal Reserve would normally be raising interest rates, and yet that has not yet been happening. They are potentially fearful that the cost of servicing the debt is going to become increasingly burdensome for the Treasury. And speaking in the broad outlines of what's going on over the next 10 to 15 years, the U.S. Treasury is piling up debt as a share of GDP, above 100% now, advancing to 150%, 160%, and eventually that's going to have to stop. They are miraculously getting away with a long-term interest rate on that debt of only a little over 2%. It's amazing to me that anybody would buy a 20-year bond at only a little over 2%, given the potential for price inflation over the next 20 years. But they're still getting away with it. The long-term average cost of servicing the debt, the Treasury debt, is 5.8%. And if it goes to a little over 4%, it's going to start eating up the federal budget. And the I'm talking about 10 to 15 years out. But right now, why I launched on that is that right now, I think the Federal Reserve is a little bit between a rock and a hard place. They're buying up a lot of the debt. The spending is up the kazoo, trillions of dollars being spent. It's not coming out of taxes. It's essentially being printed. But the Federal Reserve has got to buy that debt, and the Federal Reserve is eventually going to have to stop buying it, and is fearful about what's going to happen once it does and once the interest rate rises. So I see that as almost baked in the cake, but not necessarily over the next 4 or 5 years, the next 10 to 15, certainly, in terms of adding to the instability of the dollar and of the U.S. economy. And there, what I've just told you is almost straight from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. a very mainstream quasi-Keynesian organization that has been issuing warnings about the long-term debt for many years, unheeded warnings, and all that happens is the politicians start spending more and more, and it seems almost hopeless to get them to stop. I've been asked what is Jerome Powell thinking, the Federal Reserve Chairman? What is Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, thinking? You can only imagine that they're hoping and praying, but they can't be that stupid. They do recognize the risks, but they probably just think the miracle that the U.S. is borrowing at such a low interest rate, which is red meat to the politicians and red meat to the Treasury, mm-hmm. that you can borrow at such advantageous terms. That's been motivating all the borrowing, and they're hoping and praying that interest rate will persist. They may be right for the next few years, but sooner or later, perhaps sooner rather than later, but certainly within 10 to 15 years, that's going to be a real problem. And then the only silver lining in that is that if in 10 to 15 years the dollar becomes unstable, as the Congressional Budget Office predicts it could, then that might be an opportunity for Bitcoin to become the preferred medium of exchange.
Gotcha. Now, Gene, this is going to be a little off subject, but circling back to the sure. stock market and given sure. your experience with the New York Stock Exchange and Barron's Magazine, I was mm-hmm. really interested to get your perspective. If you've been paying attention to the AMC GameStop short squeeze going on.
I haven't looked at it in a while, but maybe you want to update me on that.
Well,
I thought it was a great event. What I understood that happened, I thought it was a great event. But yeah. Go ahead. What about it?
Well, AMC obviously has recently caught some more fire. It went from like, what, $10 a share to, I think it peaked at 73 2 weeks yeah. ago. And yeah. I mean, I got some people that are really big into it who think it's going to like 5-6 figures a share because it's going to be squeezed through the roof. And I was just kind of curious, given your expertise dealing with the market, you know, what kind of trouble these hedge funds may be in, or what potential paths of outcome could even come from something like this. I know it's unprecedented and I'm not asking you to forecast, but just given your experience, I was curious what your thoughts were.
Well, gee, the only thing I know that happened with AMC is that, and again, I'm really rooting for them. I'm a big moviegoer. I love the multiplexes. And even though, of course, most of the violent hero stories, the big epics, I really can't sit through, but I still do love to go to the movies. And I'm going to patriotically probably see the movie In the Heights. So I was very happy to learn, and this isn't really responding to your question, but at least talks about AMC. We'll get to your question in a moment, but that apparently the shorting of AMC by the hedge funds was then counteracted by Reddit and that sustained AMC stock so that a lot of their overhang of bonds turned into stock. They would have been crushed by their bond overhang. Did you know that story? The stock was raised in time so that the bonds were converted to stock, and that rescued them from oblivion, which was an odd intervention. But then I would imagine that you and I would both agree that I'm a moviegoer, you're a moviegoer, you know, the future of AMC as a theater chain is very much up for grabs. The idea that it's going to go to that its stock is going to go to the roof sounds insane to me. But one hopes that they flourish and they do okay. But if was that your question? Can you possibly be a Super Bull on AMC stock?
Is that basically, I know theoretically on a short squeeze it can go indefinitely up, infinitely up, versus, you know, shorten it can only go to zero. So I know people were a lot of these people they call themselves the apes, you know, the AMC apes that are buying up and teaming up against hedge funds. Like I've heard different people all over projecting just crazy astronomic prices on it, and I know nothing about this stuff.
I'm sorry. Then you weren't asking me about the fundamentals of it, and I haven't been tracking. So I guess I mostly have to duck the question. But well, obviously, a short squeeze, of course, can get you anywhere. And that's what we had before. It was a short squeeze. It does appear that you and I, what your net worth is at this point, Mike, but where your allocations are, or yours, Tyler, but I would stay away from it. It sounds too dangerous. Very difficult for me to call that kind of that kind of bubble. So I'll have to duck the question, except to say that I wish AMC well, and I'm happy about what the short squeeze did to rescue them, because they would have gone under. And so that was a kind of a, although I should say that the term vulture capitalism is poorly understood. You know, the vulture capitalists buy up assets that are really in the tank because they believe that they have potential. And maybe that would have happened to AMC if it really gotten crushed and gone bankrupt. And then the vulture capitalists would have recognized that there is a future to movie going. There is a future to going to the multiplex and eating the popcorn and watching the movies. So maybe they would have been rescued that way. I was very happy to see that that the short squeezers rescued them in any case. Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah, I was just curious about your take on it. So that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
So another thing you were talking about is as far as like New York City with, the Soho Forum having to proof the vaccination. Now, is that... I heard there's like some kind of like pass that's going to be in New York City, like the Excelsior or something. Have you heard much on that? It's kind of like the COVID passport type concept.
Well, yeah, you keep hearing about it. It is a little bit funny, a little bit absurd. Because of circumstances, personal circumstances, I'm 76. And you'd think that I might have been at risk from COVID, but I noticed the very good New York City numbers showed that only 6 people over the age of 76 in all of New York City had died of COVID out of 500,000 people over the age of 75, actually. So I figured, well, better to get a mild dose of COVID rather than get the vaccine. But I did come down with some kind of strange respiratory illness, and I could no longer count myself as no longer in that category. So I did get the vaccination. And then, of course, now I look at this vaccination card, and I like to hold it up to people, take a picture of it. This is really hard to forge, isn't it, this little vaccination card? Actually, very easy to forge. I got it. That forgeries are fairly common, and I anticipate, hopefully you guys will not be publishing this too much so that the people at Symphony Space hear this. I anticipate that there will be some people who will be submitting forged documents when they come to our Soho Forum at the Symphony Space to claim that they've been vaccinated, because it doesn't seem like there's much downside to that. The only thing I hear is that Gavin Newsom of California is trying to impose something more standard that's more difficult to forge. I don't know. But you know, you can't underestimate the ineptitude of government and of the powers that be.
Right.
And we always want to count on that. And so it's very possible that we'll just continue as we are. And there are a whole lot of people who are a little bit nervous about forging things, although not the ANCAPs are not too nervous about it, as I imagine. ANCAPs as a group are quite brazen about doing that sort of thing. And so, but how many ANCAPs are there in this country? You know, there's only fewer than 1 million, I guess. So I don't think that's much of a problem. But in any case, the New York City administration is altering, as you know. Obviously, de Blasio, who's a really inept dummy, terrible at everything he ever did, our current mayor, who is term limited, is going to be on the way out. There'll be a transition government. So that's going to take up a lot of time and effort. And so if you're talking about New York City, about there possibly being COVID passports, I'd be a little bit surprised if that happens right away, given the turmoil from the elections and all the other turnover of government that's going to happen. And my attitude toward the vaccines generally has been one of skepticism. There's an incredible divide that I notice among libertarians. A lot of people who think it's just a triumph of the free market, who think the vaccines are wonderful. I see just most rationally the vaccines were rushed, the side effects were not quite investigated, and that for most young people, it's better to catch the mild case of COVID you're likely to catch rather than take the vaccine, which has some potential side effects. the mild case of COVID isn't going to, you know, it's isn't going to be that terrible, and it'll give you better immunity if you do come down with it. And so that's why I don't. I'm just dismayed when I hear my own daughter talk about vaccinating my grandchildren, who it just seems ridiculous to do. In my case, again, being 76 years old, it's a little bit more of an issue. Old people are the ones who come down with serious cases, and they're, you know, if you do have, and of course, disproportionately, it's because the old people have the comorbidities, and I got vaccinated for that reason. But bottom line, I don't know if you share this feeling of mine, which it's that I've seen young people, people in their 30s, who were basically hiding under the bed when it came to the lockdowns and the pandemic, who were just you know, washing every carrot, really afraid of catching COVID, and now they've been double vaxxed and they're traveling. The powers that be have instilled fear into people, and you can't reason with fear. But if the vaccines are lifting that fear, then I welcome it. And I guess I'm an inveterate optimist. I hope that that the confidence then that if another virus hits, that a vaccine will come out, will also lift fears. The memory of the fear is when maybe will subside. But more, as I say, more specifically, the vaccines and the defeat of Trump have motivated the politicians and the local politicians to recognize, especially, that they care about the tax base. They want people to go back to work. So they are in the act of finding every excuse to loosen the lockdowns. And that's been that's good news. And I'm, of course, perhaps I share your frustration that even many libertarians don't understand that the lockdowns were an abomination, the worst thing that happened they are totalitarianism. Yeah, they're, get back to Dave Smith's joke. No, we don't live in a totalitarian country. By the way, I called the mayor this morning to ask him if I can go outside. You know, we have insanity over the land, and it dismays me to be in the company of libertarians who don't regard that as the primary libertarian issue, the lockdowns, and who don't share the outrage that they ever happened in the first place, and who might not even be familiar with Tom Wood's very good quiz. I don't know if you've seen it. All the charts, yeah, on lockdowns and masks, and they didn't work. But more to the point, there was never any excuse to have them in the first place. The logic of the Great Barrington Declaration, which was basically formulated by progressives, it is a very government oriented document, that they wanted focused protection, and focused protection by and large would have been done voluntarily even in any kind of libertarian society, but they wanted money for people who had to go to work, who might have had illness, might have been obese. So, and I don't necessarily oppose that. If I'm going to argue with most people about the lockdowns, it's very easy for me to just say, just read the Great Barrington Declaration. It wasn't written by libertarians. It wasn't written by the people at the American Institute for Economic Research who were sponsoring it. It was written by people who are basically progressives and don't mind government intervention, but it's the same document within that context. And so I just hope that we'll eventually be able to teach even non-libertarians that this was truly a disastrous time for American society and for the world, what occurred. So again, that's more answer than you bargained for. I'm hoping that that New York City opens up. With respect to the requiring that everybody be vaccinated, that is being required by Symphony Space. It's odd that they are telling us that anybody on our staff can simply provide proof of not having COVID. Just, you know, 36-hour proof that you don't have COVID. That 3 days ago you took a test. COVID, and I was hoping that they would be logical and say the same thing applies to the audience, to the ticket holders, and yet They didn't say that. They said all ticket holders have got to have proof of double vaccination. Although my operations head, she's 32 years old. She's not going to be vaccinated. She hasn't been vaccinated. She only has to provide proof that she doesn't have COVID. I know what you guys think, but I believe that, you know, you can sort of understand that that if you want to attract an audience to your venue, that you might want to say, provide proof that you don't have COVID, that that's reasonable to ask, and that even in a pure, even among pure libertarians, you might want to say that, even though I wouldn't require it. It certainly wasn't required when we went to the venues in Florida, mm-hmm. but at least I could understand it. The more extreme demand that you be vaccinated seems a bit unreasonable, and certainly has me outraged. But we were very, very eager to get this debate going. Scott Horton is coming, and Bill Crystal is coming to this debate, and we had to deal with that trade-off, and so we chose to accept what the Symphony Space wanted. We are in the process of trying to establish a permanent home for the Soho Forum. We had a home called the Subculture Theater at 45 Bleecker Street, which was ideal for us. It had a bar. It had space for my wife to offer food, to offer catering, so we could have a party both before and after. Because the twofold mission of the Soho Forum is not just to have a debate of interest to libertarians, but to get people together, to have them discuss the debate, both the topic and to talk with the debaters afterwards, and to get to know each other, to socialize, to network. And so we had that at the Subculture Theater, and then because of a strange series of events, that went out of business. We're looking at another venue where we could possibly have that, and I'm a bit nervous about what they're going to ask of us with respect to vaccination and with respect to proof that you don't have COVID. I hope that at least if they're going to put their foot down about it, that they only ask that at least that you don't have to prove that you've been vaccinated, just prove that you don't have COVID. Because this is New York City, and that is a little bit of a problem. And of course, there's been a lot of Twitter followers who've been telling me, what the hell are you doing in that concentration camp of a city, New York City? And what can I say? I've been here for over 50 years. It's unlikely that I'll be able to move. Unlikely that I'll really know how to move. We have taken the show on the road, as I've said, and we will do so in the future. But we're sort of stuck in New York City at this point. So that's the long answer to where we stand at the Soho Forum with respect to the reopening of the economy and the lifting of the lockdowns.
Okay. So, Gene, one other quick little question. You did mention Dave Smith there. So in the event that Dave Smith does run and win the presidency, what role will you play in his cabinet?
Well, I think that I should probably just be his Ehrlichman or Haldeman, just his second in command, because I've got to keep whispering in Dave's ear, please do not call yourself the most consistent motherfucker. Because look, you know, there's nothing wrong with that as far as I'm concerned. But to begin with, Dave, you're not going to get elected if you keep talking like that. And in addition, Dave, clean up your grammar somewhat. I don't know if you know that Dave is incapable of saying, you and I had a good time last night. It's always me and you had a good time last night. And that's ungrammatical. In addition, I think that Dave, who, by the way, I greatly respect, I should say, I'm kidding him now, but I believe that Dave went through a phase, which I hope is ended, where he obviously spent a lot of his youth, you know, drinking, drugging, and who knows, going to orgies in his 20s. And then he became a bourgeois. He became a husband and a father, and he went the other extreme. That's what can happen to you when you become a sort of a late convert. And he obviously loves being a dad. He's basically a Jewish guy married to a sweet shiksa, and he's having a great time living in his house. And I think it's terrific. You know, he must be a wonderful husband and father, because he keeps talking about how happy he is in that state. But then when you start saying things like he did a year ago, I don't know if you ever saw him, he said he talked about I think it was specifically insulting some woman, but I guess he made some statement to the effect that women who've never had children are all screwed up, that if you're a woman who's never had children, there's something wrong with you. I mean, you know, he's suddenly opining about the desirability of the marriage state and of having kids. And I was on his show and I was trying to tell him that, look, we're both thick libertarians. We both have sort of values. Yes. But then I started talking to him about sex workers. That was probably not too smart of me. And I actually asked him how he would feel if his daughter decided to become a sex worker. So that probably really, really inflamed him and drove him.
Ruffling feathers.
Yeah. So I really ruffled his feathers that way. But I was trying to teach him to be a little bit more tolerant. I believe he's quieted down a little bit about his moralizing. The other part of it as well is that he says unequivocally that he believes that abortion is murder. And then he echoes Ron Paul. But I heard Ron Paul on The View, you know, that daily show with a bunch of women. Ron Paul was sort of waffling when he was asked about it. He basically said that he just doesn't think the federal government should be in charge of it. Federal government never was in charge of it. It should be left to the states. And he said, well, if a state votes for it, then I guess you'll have your way. So he didn't unequivocally declare what he privately believes, that abortion is murder, and probably Dave should follow Ron Paul's lead in that regard, in recognizing that I privately disapprove of it, but I only think that it's not something for Roe versus Wade. Dave seems to be a little bit more extreme about it. It's difficult to argue with that. I myself tend in the direction of Walter Block, who has a different view, which we could go into, but that's a digression. I still think that it's very heartening that Dave does want to run for the presidency. And I do think that he could potentially reach a large audience. You probably know that he was debating the issue because we all are well aware of the fact that Ron Paul converted so many people and achieved such attention because he was running for the nomination of the Republican Party. And so he was able to face down Giuliani, for example, about how, you know, they don't hate us for our freedoms. They hate us because we're in their backyard killing them. And Giuliani uh-huh. asked him to back that. So all of those historic moments were only possible because Ron Paul was running for the nomination of the Republican Party ticket. Dave argues that he could still be a Ron Paul II because he has access to more media out there than Ron Paul did at the time. And I wish him well, I wish him luck. And I think that by and large, Dave is an articulate, fast-thinking guy who, by the way, I gather, does not say motherfucker when he's on TV, so he knows not to curse. I doubt very much that he cleans up his grammar. He's got two thumbs up from me, and my criticisms of him are a little bit carping. But with that said, I was talking to Dennis Propp up at the Free State. So they're going to have a different debate. As you know, Dave was debating I forget the guy's name. You probably noticed that on Lions of Liberty. He was with Thoe Bishop. He was debating Thoe Bishop on that issue. But then there's another dimension to the debate, which is, of course, Thoe Bishop said working within the Republican Party is still the best way. And Dave, it was a very friendly, very engaging debate. Dave was arguing, no, there's potential to do another kind of Ron Paul through the Libertarian Party itself. But then the second dimension to it is, as Dennis Pratt put it to me, if 1-2% of the population is libertarian, we've got a few million people. If a considerable portion of those could move to New Hampshire, then maybe if you really want to get something done in the world, then maybe that's a real hope. I think maybe Dave should run for the presidency and then consider moving his family. Hopefully by then he'll have five kids, moving them all up to New Hampshire. And after having run for the presidency and maybe not winning, which will be a big disappointment to me, because if Dave doesn't give me the number two spot, I could at least be head of the Treasury or Secretary of State, where I believe I could be able to do a lot of good. That would be a real disappointment. But if he loses, then he possibly could move to New Hampshire and start running for the governorship, and that could be the other thing he does. Because again, libertarians have scarce resources. I myself have throughout my life been a member of the Chattering Classes. As you guys can see, I've written, I've given talks. And while I think I serve a purpose, I think you guys serve a great purpose by running your podcast, I've always been looking for people who really try to get things done, the pragmatists, who might be able to win some real tangible victories for libertarianism, rather than people like me who just keep talking about it. And so I take a keen interest in these things. And very arguably, I lean in the direction of thinking that our scarce resources should be devoted to creating the free state of New Hampshire, even though I'm not moving to New Hampshire. But the Soul Forum will continue to support the free state in many ways. I'm pretty sure that this is not the last time that we'll have a substantial presence at Porkfest.
Sounds great. Smith Epstein 24, everybody. Don't forget it.
Two Jews. It's a lucky break that not everybody knows that Dave is a goddamn Jew, just like me. Two Jews running on the ticket. That's exactly what the libertarians would do. just put all your Jewish eggs into one basket and let the Gentiles eat your heart out, Gentiles. It's going to be two Jews.
Looking forward to it. Well, Gene, yeah. We're a little past an hour. I'm extremely grateful for your time. Thanks again. Sure. Tyler, any closing questions?
No, this was good. This was it was a good, insightful conversation.
Solved all the problems of the world, guys. And
that's right.
Absolutely.
And I didn't make you do any forecasting this time, so I thought you might like
that. Well, I did. No, come on now. I talked about the dangers going forward. And I did say that I buy $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, $1,000 gold every month. And that's the classic, very unimaginative dollar cost averaging, which means that that psychologically it's kind of nice because Bitcoin now has downside correction. So that means I can buy a little bit more of it because I'm buying $1,000 worth. It's a fixed amount. So you're diversifying over time. You buy less of it if it's going up, more of it if it's gone down. I still have fairly substantial profits from having done this. And so that in a way, I think is about the only recommendation I can make to people. With respect to gold, I'm a little less sure. So maybe it's just Bitcoin. I think that's potentially the best hedge against the future. And so that's my specific investment recommendation.
Perfect. And any plugs, any social media, Soho Forum?
Follow me on my Twitter handle where I announce most things and I sound off on most things that are of interest and promote articles I'm doing. And that's at Gene Soho Forum, at Gene Soho Forum. And again, because you guys are mostly this, your vast audience are podcast listeners, the Soho Forum debates podcast is where you can catch all of my debates and all of the debates we've done at the Soul Forum. I've done 7 of them. We've had over 50, so most of them have been done by others. But if you scroll through the Soul Forum Debates podcast, you'll find a lot of interesting debates on racism. We've had two prior debates on Bitcoin, but Bitcoin keeps changing. The issues keep changing. We're going to have another Bitcoin debate at Porkfest. And while tickets can't be bought to Porkfest, and actually the hotels are all sold out. And so I guess the thing to do is to sort of camp out and invade Porkfest that way, which you could still do.
Yeah. Sounds great. Yeah. And hopefully we can cross paths at Freedom Fest. We'll have a booth there.
Looking for, are you going to be there too, Tyler? Or just,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And you, what is it? You guys are, what exactly are you doing? I've heard this before. You're going to be a bunch of reporters. What are you going to do?
Yeah. They have a media row. So it's media podcasters and news channels. Yeah. So we got a booth set up there. We'll be there interviewing the speakers and trying to observe and report on the event.
So, God, so I won't get a chance with you. You'll say, yeah, I spoke to you already. You're boring. I'll be doing the speakers, but you guys won't talk to me. All right, so you're going to interview a lot of the speakers. Well, that's good. Well, look, you got a chance to talk to Tom and Scott. I mean, those are the two greats who will be there. And I think you'll have a great time. And of course, yeah, no, I'm looking forward to seeing you both up there. No, it's a great time. It was held in Las Vegas, as you probably know, for many years, and then Las Vegas canceled it. And I think it's great that we're going to have a look at South Dakota for a while. I always enjoyed going to Las Vegas. This has been my 7th, 8th time at Freedom Fest. And part of it is indeed getting to know people and hanging out. And that's always always a pleasure to basically hang out with people of like mind and being in a community of people with like mind, as we will have at Freedom Fest and I will have at Pork Fest, is so much of what I look forward to.
Yeah. Sounds great, Gene. We can't wait. Finally getting down to the final month here. So we're looking forward to it. So, Gene, thanks again. Really appreciate your time. And we'll see you in South Dakota.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Save a little more this month. Chime checking accounts have features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe and no monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.